loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we go to Managua, Nicaragua, where Dan Kovalik and Max Blumenthal are reporting on the ground on the protests and the counter-revolution that has been waged against the Sandinista government. Today is the 39th anniversary of the victory of the Sandinista revolution against the U.S.-backed dictator Somoza. We're going to be talking about what really was behind the protests, the Nicaraguan government's response, how much support the Sandinistas have, and why and how the U.S. media covered these events. And then we continue our weekly Thursday series, every Thursday, called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, U.S.-Russian relations are on the rocks, not just because of President Trump's foreign policy, but also because members of both parties on Capitol Hill are demanding that Trump walk back his public statements supporting an easing of tensions with Moscow and say publicly that the Russians interfered in the 2016 presidential election. Next, the British Press Association reported today that Metropolitan Police detectives have identified the alleged perpetrators of a poison attack against a Russian defector and his daughter. Media reports say that Sergei and Yulia Skripal were poisoned by, quote, several Russians, unquote. UK Security Minister Ben Wallace called the reports ill-informed and wild speculation. Then Israel's parliament, the Knesset, yesterday passed a highly controversial law that defines Israel as the national home of the Jewish people, says that only Jews have the right to self-determination, downgrades Arabic from an official language to a protected one, and promotes the establishment of new Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. Israel is virtually alone in the world in not guaranteeing equality for all of its citizens. And then a Spanish Supreme Court judge on Thursday dropped an extradition request for six politicians on charges of rebellion for their roles in promoting independence for Catalonia, including former President Carlos Puigdemont. The decision was a major setback for Spain's central government, which has sought to crack down on the region's secessionist movement. And finally, consumers should expect to pay higher prices for imported cars if President Trump's auto tariffs are enacted. Car sellers say they will pass on all the new costs to consumers. The prices of top-selling foreign cars could rise between $1,400 and $7,000. And in other headlines, President Trump has come out against Vladimir Putin's offer to swap people of interest for state interviews amidst a great deal of pressure. Putin had been offering to give the 12 Russian citizens indicted last week on charges, including identity theft and conspiracy to commit computer crimes, to the U.S. in exchange for U.S. citizens, including Bill Browder and former U.S. Ambassador to Russia Michael McFaul. President Trump's nominee to head the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, Kathy Craninger, testified before the Senate Banking Committee today. She's currently a senior official in the Office of Management and Budget and has made clear that she will carry on the current anti-worker, pro-business policies of the current head, Mick Mulvaney. French authorities began an investigation today targeting Alexandra Benalla, a security aide to President Emmanuel Macron. Benalla was caught on video joining in on the police repression of a May Day demonstration he was sent to observe. Macron's team initially did not report Benalla's conduct to authorities and only suspended him for 15 days. That conduct included dragging a protester and striking and stomping on another one. The Syrian government continued its successful offensive against armed groups in the country's south, securing an agreement for the opposition to withdraw from the strategic region of Quneitra. Under the agreement, fighters are given the option of evacuating to Idlib province, which is largely controlled by Al-Qaeda. Quneitra has been especially hotly contested due to its proximity to the Golan Heights, a region of Syria occupied by Israel since 1967. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Nicaragua. Today, Nicaragua celebrates the 39th anniversary of the victory of the Sandinista revolution against the Somoza dictatorship. Nicaragua has been in deep crisis since protests began 3 months ago as opponents of the government set up barricades and clashed with authorities. 280 people have been killed and more than 1,800 injured. The demonstrations began following changes in the country's social security system and have now emerged, revolved, or devolved into a full-fledged effort to overthrow the Sandinista government. We're joined from Managua, Nicaragua, by Max Blumenthal. He is a journalist and best-selling author whose latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He is also the senior editor of Gray Zone Project and co-host of the podcast Moderate Rebels. And we're also joined from Managua by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer. He is the author of several books, including The Plot to Attack Iran. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Great to be on with you.
Thank you. Max Blumenthal, let's start with you today, 39th anniversary of the 1979 revolution. I was talking to Dan before we came on air. If you're getting your news from any of the corporate-owned media outlets in the United States, and sadly that's where most people in this country are getting their news, you would think that there's all across the board an armed uprising against people, by people against the Sandinista government, that the Sandinista government has no base of support, and they're just, you know, sort of gratuitously murdering political freedom fighters. Anyway, you're there. What's your take?
We've been here for several days speaking to people who have been at the center of events since April, since this violent unrest began. And these are people who have been visited by absolutely zero Western reporters until we arrived. We have met with people who are facing campaign against Sandinismo unlike any other in Nicaraguan history. And I'm fully aware of what took place in the 1980s when the U.S. armed the opposition, armed the Contras. What's happening now is unprecedented because people who are simply sports reporters for leftist radio stations like Radio Ya, which is the number one radio station in Managua, privately funded, not a government-funded radio station, which has served the community and provided social services. These people are living in terror. They are hunted at night. They have to sleep inside what's left of the radio station, which is actually a makeshift station. And we visited their main studios yesterday, which were completely torched by the opposition, with 22 employees inside, and the employees narrowly escaped being burned alive. Many others have been burned alive. We also visited a student leader who was originally part of the protests at the Public University of Upoli in Managua in solidarity with students against the social security reforms, Veronica Gutierrez, until she turned against the reforms. And now she's living under 24/7 police guard in a safe house and cannot leave the small zone of the city where she's under protection because she's not only been targeted, her family has been targeted, her car has been identified by the opposition. So this is just one dimension that we've been able to discover since we've been here, which is the campaign of intimidation against anyone affiliated with the government. And we're constantly told that this is a tyrannical government, which is waging a campaign of press intimidation and is massacring the opposition. And there absolutely have been deaths on the opposition side. There's no denying that. But what we're not told is that basic people who just simply want to participate in this government and serve their community are facing intimidation, threats, and even are being murdered in a way that didn't happen in the 80s because the Contras didn't penetrate Managua. So this is one dimension. And the other dimension, which I'll talk about in a minute and Dan can speak to, is the level of U.S. interference, the way that the U.S. crafted this uprising, the way that it was designed months, if not years in advance. So, you know, it's been really eye-opening to be here for just a few days.
Dan Kovalik, there was a mass march on July 7th for peace. In other words, to actually in support, really, of, it would seem to me, of the government's position. Got no coverage here, none. You and Max will be there today for the 39th anniversary. Again, the narrative here in the media is that there is this tyrannical government that's shooting down and killing its own people, and the people are trying to either respond or resist or hide. And as a consequence, it's really the government versus the people. Anyway, Let's go ahead with you. What's your view?
Yes, I think it's almost the exact opposite of what's being described. Just to talk a little bit about what we've seen, we also visited a credit union yesterday named after Che Guevara that was also burned to the ground with the computers and all the records inside and all the vehicles outside. Scores of them were also burned beyond repair. This was a credit union that provides microfinancing to small businesses, to small farmers, and it is a lifeline for poor and working class people. It was burned to the ground by this right-wing opposition. They are targeting the social goods that the Sandinistas have created for poor people in this country. That is what's being destroyed here. They are destroying popular media outlets like Radio Jaw, as Max mentioned. It's those that are being burned to the ground, not the opposition media outlets. I mean, the irony is the opposition says, oh, we're being censored. No, it's the opposition that is censoring the Sandinistas. As Max and I talked last night, it's actually the Sandinistas being hunted. They don't have control. And I think people have to realize that what is happening here is not some sort of revolution against the government. It is a counter-revolution, and it is being supported by the U.S., which Max can talk more about.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Max, too, is it possible for the average Nicaraguan citizen to demonstrate peaceably, or is Managua in a situation where the average person is under constant attack with these right-wing militias or instigators, agitators?
Well, there have been many protests since Daniel Ortega was elected in a free and fair election that I covered, and he was inaugurated in early 2007, and I was there at the plaza to see him stand on stage with Hugo Chavez and Evo Morales and leaders of the pink tide that was washing across Latin America. And I knew that there would be a pushback by the United States targeting all of these figures and their programs one by one, and that Nicaragua would be targeted at the tail end. Protests started to build against Ortega around a variety of issues. And there was not any sense that the protesters were forbidden from carrying out peaceful or even really ferocious, aggressive protests that I wouldn't describe as armed in any way. There were massive taxi strikes. There was a protest against a Chinese-backed canal project in an ecologically sensitive area. Obviously, the U.S. had an interest there, but there were local concerns that were, I would say, legitimate. What we're seeing now is something completely different. It's obvious that the protesters are adopting lessons not only from Venezuela, where they've been in open communication with leaders of the violent Garimbas, but Ukraine as well. And so what we've heard from students who've actually been a part of these occupations of public universities, Dan mentioned how a public credit union was torched. What we're seeing is an all-out attack on the public sector, an attack on the base, the spine that holds the working poor of Nicaragua together and prevents them from sinking into extreme poverty. We've seen an attack on public universities. And so there have been students marching into places like Upoli, the public university I mentioned earlier, and we interviewed one of the students who I mentioned is now in a safe house under police guard who had participated in that march. And she said that when she turned against the opposition, it was when they started openly collaborating with criminal elements led by a criminal gang leader named Viper, who basically were the armed opposition. People wearing masks who had mysterious caches of rifles, members of the MRS, who are former Sandinistas who collaborate with the right wing, began bringing in cash and trucks full of water and food to the university. She said she was shocked at the level of outside support. And as these gang members began taking over the university, they began carrying out acts of crime and even rape and violence against people in the local community using the university as a base. And she essentially escaped and denounced them. And now she's a target of violent criminals. The figure I mentioned, Viper, and this is widely reported in Nicaragua, has been arrested. And Felix Maradiaga, who is the head of one of the main channels for money from the State Department-backed USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy, the American government's regime change arm, have been collaborating fairly openly. And this student, Veronica Gutierrez, described meetings between these two figures on the third floor of the university during its occupation. So what we're looking at is not a bunch of technocratic, hopeful, idealistic students. We're looking at a counter-revolution using as muscle hardcore criminal elements. And these are the figures who manned the so-called tranques, the roadblocks, which paralyzed Nicaragua's economy until now and basically prevented any growth from taking place in the economy this year and have cost the economy, according to sources we've talked to, about $500 million. Just imagine if this took place in the United States, what the U.S. government's response would be. It would be, imagine if right-wing militias backed by a foreign power started setting up roadblocks across the U.S., taking truckers hostage, committing crimes against local communities. I mean, it wouldn't be pretty what the government would do. And so there have been scores and scores of deaths, many on the opposition side. But the question is, how would this government have survived if it didn't respond with some level of force?
Dan Kovalik, let's pursue that thing, because that thing meaning the issue of violence. You know, truth, of, as we know from the cliche, truth is the first casualty of war. In civil wars or in civil strife, what is the truth is completely, there's always at least two narratives. Completely different. If you look at the American South after the U.S. Civil War, the Northern Army imposed a kind of dictatorship over the South, which was challenged ultimately by the defeated plantation owners, the defeated slavocracy, with their own military force called the KKK. And if you got your news from the Southern side, it would be like the Northern troops and the abolitionists and those who were supporting the former enslaved people were complete terrorists. I mean, that's the language. That's the colorful rhetoric. And just the opposite for the KKK until the North finally ideologically capitulated to the KKK like around 1885. But it's unavoidable in a way in a situation like this when the opposition becomes an armed opposition that the government responds with force unless it passively just decides to be overthrown, which the Sandinistas have decided not to be overthrown. And then you have Western media, which is completely 100% in an unmitigated way supporting the overthrow of the Sandinistas, using every incident of violence, exaggerating it or reporting on it, covering it to create this image, this impression by the American people that the Sandinistas are simply bloodthirsty. Now, both you and Max are saying there's another side to the story. And in fact, that's not the truth at all. It in fact is perhaps just the opposite. What do you expect today on the 39th anniversary? Will there be a show of force and public support for the Sandinistas?
There will be a massive outpouring of support for the Sandinistas. President Daniel Ortega is now polling at 50% approval after this crisis, which is amazing, okay, given the crisis that has happened. Max and I have heard a number of times being here the new a song that is now very popular in Nicaragua, written by campesinos, called Daniel Se Queda, Daniel Stays. And it is a song in favor of the president. Once the smoke has cleared here, and it is clearing very quickly, and the truth is coming out, people are realizing that the so-called protesters that were committing these acts of violence were not their friends. They were not here to build democracy, but they were here to destroy. They weren't here to create anything, and that it was the Sandinistas that are protecting them and the police that are protecting them. And that if anything, Ortega actually pulled the police off the streets for some time, much to the chagrin of a lot of people who wanted them for security. But I think, you know, the FSLN, the Sandinistas, were very cautious about overreacting. They showed a lot of restraint. And the people realized, hey, this government is defending us against terrorist elements. And this government is now stronger than it was, I believe, before these events. And we've been told that by a number of people, and that Sandissimo is stronger than ever. And it's pretty inspiring.
Max Blumenthal, what precipitated this crisis? Let's talk about the pensions and what the government tried to do, under what pressure was it, and then how it evolved or devolved into where we are.
There was a crisis looming. The Social Security pension system, which is one of the bedrocks, the Sandinismo guarantee to the country, was not going to be solvent going into 2019. And the IMF had basically presented a blueprint that the business community delivered to Daniel Ortega to start privatizing health clinics and raise the retirement age, which would have been unacceptable for the working poor, which are really represent the Nicaraguan masses. And so Ortega proposed actually imposing a higher tax, particularly on business owners, as well as retirees, but the tax would have been lower for retirees. Protests immediately erupted. And it was strange. It reminded me distinctly of the protests in Ukraine, which erupted when President Yanukovych rejected an association agreement with the EU that would have imposed harsh austerity on Ukraine and instead took a more preferential deal with Russia. These economic deals, they don't seem like they would trigger massive violent unrest. It's as if there was some kind of preparation and that opposition elements were looking for a spark to turn towards regime change. And that's exactly what happened in Nicaragua. Right now, there are no Social Security reforms. Ortega rescinded his proposal. There is no plan to keep Social Security solvent. And the opposition was opportunistically exploiting that moment to then enter into a phase of what can only be described as a soft coup. It might not even be that soft, given the level of violence that's taken place. And so, some of the people who joined in with the opposition early on are now disillusioned because they saw the true face of the opposition, which came in the form of masked armed men at roadblocks, deliberately paralyzing the country's economy. And they started to remember their experience during the Civil War and the devastation and exhaustion they experienced. But they can also look to the models of Syria and Libya and even Ukraine, where there's now a 25% poverty rate. 25% of Ukrainians are living in poverty. So the countries where these sort of regime change operations either achieved their objective or partially succeeded, in the case of Syria, have turned countries into failed states. And that actually has been a U.S. objective for Nicaragua all along, because Nicaragua can potentially present an example to the rest of Central America, which the United States needs to keep weak and subjugated in order to control shipping lines and and ultimately to sever South America from Mexico.
Dan, we're the time is running down here, but again, for people who may not have been born yet or too young at the time, the Reagan administration, the U.S. government, waged an absolute criminal war against the Nicaraguan people and against the Sandinistas when they overthrew a U.S.-backed bloody dictator, Somoza, in 1979. That war went on for 10 years, and the United States, the CIA, funded the National Guardsmen of the old dictatorship, the Somoza government, these brutal thugs, who Ronald Reagan declared to be the moral equivalent of quote, our founding fathers. That's another issue. But, that was a war by the most powerful military in the world against a country which at that time had a population of 2.5 million. And the U.S. actually mined the harbors so that the U.S. put explosive devices in the water so that ships could not come to Nicaragua.
Which is an international war crime, by the way.
And Nicaragua went to the International Criminal Court, and the International Criminal Court, or the World Court, ruled 15-0 against the United States and said it was a war crime. And the U.S. just said, too bad, we're not going to acknowledge the jurisdiction of this court. But you can't get more criminal than what the U.S. has actually done to Nicaragua. It seems that the Nicaraguan people will never be forgiven, never be left alone by the U.S. because they dared to carry out a revolution against what was basically a U.S. puppet dictator, Somoza. Anyway, go ahead.
No, that's absolutely right. Noam Chomsky has pointed this out a number of times, that yes, the U.S. will never forgive Nicaragua for overthrowing the U.S.-backed dictator, just like it won't forgive Iran for overthrowing the U.S.-backed Shah. And what we're seeing right now is that vindictiveness of the U.S. against a popular revolution that has inspired the world, inspired many of us in the United States. That's why we're down here now, because we were so moved by the David, Nicaragua, defending itself against the Goliath, the United States. And we need to be clear which side we need to be on. And that's on the side of Nicaragua and the side of the Sandinista revolution, which still has a lot to teach us.
Max Blumenthal, we have about 4 minutes left. You know, you can go all around the world. You were talking about Ukraine. We're talking about Nicaragua. Dan Kovalik just mentioned the Iranians haven't been forgiven for overthrowing the Shah. Well, in 1953, this would be next month, August 19th will be the 65th anniversary of the coup by the CIA and British intelligence that overthrew the Mossack Day government in Iran, a democratically elected government. That government sought to carry out an audit to see the books of the Anglo-Iranian oil company, now known as BP. AIOC BP refused to do that. And so Mossack Day and the Iranian parliament nationalized Iran's oil. U.S. imposed extreme sanctions on the country. There was disaffection and hardship, especially for the middle class who went into the streets. So it looked like a popular uprising. But beneath it all was this destabilization campaign. I mean, when we talk about America, we can't talk about American global power without really truly understanding the covert character of these kind of operations, which are so dominating in terms of U.S. foreign policy. 2 minutes left.
Yeah, I'm really glad you steered the conversation in that direction, because I'm here to, I've written about the sophistication of the U.S. destabilization operation in Nicaragua, how the National Endowment for Democracy and USAID channeled close to $10 million last year into training supposed activists and cultivating the opposition for a soft coup attempt. And now I'm beginning to kind of fill in some of the blanks in a really eye-opening way. What I've seen so far from some of the young people here is that they began being bombarded the day after the opposition launched its campaign, with three people dead so far. We're not talking about hundreds dead. WhatsApp messages encouraging them from unknown numbers, and I've recorded some of these messages. I have them in my possession, encouraging them to go to the and take the public universities. There has been sponsored content appearing on their Facebook pages that directs them to Voice of America interviews with protesters who are demanding that the U.S. send arms to the opposition, being prompted by Voice of America reporters. Voice of America has been central in this. And then Facebook messages sent from unknown accounts that young people here didn't know, encouraging them to sign petitions and share petitions demanding Ortega's ouster. And we're talking about on April 20th, the day after the protests began. So regime change and the sophisticated apparatus to stimulate it were set in motion immediately after the Social Security protests began. It was all about regime change. And it's taking the way that we're kind of targeted with psychological and influence operations in the West is pales in comparison to the amount of manipulation that the local population here has been targeted with. And many people initially fell for it, as I mentioned, until they saw the true face of the U.S.-backed opposition and backed away. And that's the moment we're at right now, where the opposition is in full retreat, and we're going to see a really strong show of strength, serious show of strength in Managua's plaza today as the country celebrates the 39th anniversary of the Sandinista Revolution.
We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Managua by Max Blumenthal. Max is a journalist and best-selling author whose latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He has a new movie out called Killing Gaza with Dan Cohen. He's also the senior editor of Gray Zone Project and co-host of the podcast Moderate Rebels. And we've also been joined from Managua by Dan Kovalik. Dan is a human rights and labor lawyer. He is the author of numerous books, the latest being The Plot to Attack Iran. Stay with us. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News magazine. Paul, good to talk to you.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show, guys.
Paul, there's a lot that's happened this past week, and so I have a lot of questions for you. But first, let's start with the FCC and Ajit Pai and a lawsuit that you have filed against the FCC.
Well, it's not a lawsuit, actually. This is a comment that we filed with them. So what's happened is for many years now, we've been the Human Rights Defense Center has led the Prison Phone Justice Campaign to try to seek relief for prisoners and their families that are subjected to these outrageously high phone bills for prison and jail phone calls. We'd had some previous success. We'd had a modest amount of success under the previous FCC, where they'd actually taken steps to cap the cost of phone calls and ban some of the outrageous fees that these companies were charging. And everything was going good. Then we had the election, and Ajit Pai was elevated from commissioner to the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. And the prison telecom companies had filed a challenge to to the previous order that had been filed. And literally within days of taking office, Ajit Pai ordered FCC attorneys not to defend the agency order. And that was something that was very much it's pretty much unheard of. Typically agencies will defend their orders. So he did not do so. And not surprisingly, the court ruled in favor of the prison telecom companies because the agency that issued the order, in this case the FCC, kind of threw in the towel. But one thing that was interesting about when he was seeking confirmation to be the head of the FCC, though, was he disclosed that when he'd worked at the law firm of Jenner and Block, that he had represented Securus, which is one of the biggest prison telephone companies in the U.S., that they had been his client. And so since then, we have asked that he recuse himself from any matters involving the prison phone industry because there appears to be a conflict of interest there, in that pretty much every time that anything dealing with the prison telecom industry has come up on his watch, he's always voted in their favor. He's never done anything to seek any type of action that would in any way impinge their profits and their ability to gouge the public. And so we think that there's certainly at a minimum the appearance of a conflict of interest here in regards to his relationship with the private prison telephone industry. And so far, of course, he hasn't done so. And this is in the context of one of the companies, Securus, his former client, is now buying another prison telecom company, and which is going to basically cement their position even more of basically a duopoly between two companies.
And there have been a handful of court cases about this, have there not? And so far, the companies have not been compelled to either reduce their prices or to make calling easier or to benefit prisoners in any way.
Exactly. And the problem with that is that the courts wind up saying that, well, the FCC is the agency that has jurisdiction. The courts can't impose fair, reasonable rates on the on these prison phone companies. So basically it's basically developed into a catch-22. The courts say they can't do anything, only the FCC can. The FCC can, but they're not willing to. And basically the prison telecom companies continue to rake in billions of dollars of profits on the backs of prisoners and their families.
Well, this is certainly an issue that is important for the families of every incarcerated American. I can tell you from firsthand experience that, prisons at every level, whether it's local, state, or federal, say that they want to encourage prisoner reintegration into the family unit, and then they make it as difficult as possible, in part by keeping telephone calls either extraordinarily expensive, prohibiting them altogether, or having only video visits, which are even more expensive than the phone calls.
And I think this is down to the whole mentality, though, where both the prison officials, the government officials, and their collaborators in the private telecom industry basically view prisoners and their families as profit centers to be mined for as much money as they can basically extort out of them for anyone that wants to maintain contact or communication with a loved one in prison. It's literally all about monetizing human contact and monetizing family relationships.
Paul, I want to switch to kind of an odd story that was first carried in the Daily Beast. I actually had to read it twice because I didn't fully appreciate it and understand it the first time I was reading it. It's entitled, "A Native American Tribe Has an $800 Million Contract to Run ICE Detention Centers." How in the world did that happen?
Well, I mean, this goes to the whole thing about the trend of trying to use prisons and jails as a tool of economic development. And I think that this is kind of the classic example of, you know, whether it's casinos or jails, this is a great way for, someone to make money. And the fact that they're, the fact that they're doing this, I think, shouldn't be too much of a surprise. So, and, you know, and I think this is just a case, too, of where, you know, I think plenty of companies, organizations, and indeed individuals are seeing mass incarceration, whether it's in the immigration context or the criminal context, as a chance to feed at the government trough. And this doesn't seem to be any exception. So,
yeah, the interesting thing here is we're talking about the Port Isabel Detention Center in Los Fresnos, Texas. It's the facility itself is owned by ICE, which is not unusual, but the guards are contracted from a firm called Aetna Incorporated. It's a conglomerate of businesses owned by a company that is a federally recognized Alaska Native person company. So it's owned, well, it's at least majority owned by Native Alaskans, which gives it this minority status and makes it more appealing for the federal government to use it, especially in something like this. And this way, ICE is happy, justice is happy, and this tribe is happy. At the same time, and this is in the subtitle of the article, it says the National Congress of American Indians has called Trump's immigration policies simply immoral. One member group, though, is taking a very different approach, and that very different approach is to profit on the misery of these undocumented immigrants.
And I think that one of the things, too, that's not exactly clear to me is who actually owns the facility or rather who's actually making the money.
Right. That is not clear.
Because, you know, one of the things that's really that the private prison industry has become adept at doing is they use municipalities as cutouts to undercut competitive bidding requirements with the federal government. You've got, for example, the city of Eloy in Arizona. They have contracts with CoreCivic, which used to be known as Corrections Corporation of America, to run immigration prisons and criminal prisons in Texas. And basically, the city of Eloy is nothing more than a cutout to send the money through to get around competitive bidding requirements. So, in other words, the city of Eloy is not doing anything besides collecting a paycheck for serving as this conduit, which I'm not an expert on government procurement, but it sounds like contract fraud to me, but maybe it isn't. And so I think that just the fact that, you know, you've got Native American tribes doing this, because I'm kind of wondering is, okay, what does a tribe in Alaska have to do with running an immigration prison in Texas? And that kind of makes me think that they're being used more as some type of cutout or some type of, they're working around some type of get around in federal contracting requirements to get the contract. And basically someone else is making the money and they're just getting a cut of it in exchange for the use of their Native American tribal status.
I think that's exactly right. There was kind of an interesting statement by an attorney who was representing a group of prisoners who had sued the facility. And he said that he had no idea that the facility was connected in any way to a First Nations group. He said the guards there are almost exclusively of Latino heritage. They hire locally. And I honestly doubt that the guards even know that they're working for a First Nations corporation. And, you know, I want to say one other thing, too, on that. You used the word cutout a moment ago, and that's really exactly what this is. These private prison corporations are very good at using cutouts in order to mask the chain of ownership of some of these contracts. And as a result, the American people really don't know who owns what, who runs what, who works for whom. It's a mystery, even though they're publicly traded companies.
Well, and I think that's, you know, let's point out that only some of them are publicly traded. CoreCivic is publicly traded, so is Geo.
Yeah, those were the two I was talking about specifically, right?
Right. Management Training Corporation is publicly held. And then some of the other companies like Horizon that provides health, that is contracted to provide health care charges, for example, they're privately held. And the prison telecom companies we're talking about earlier, Global Tellink and Securus, are all owned by hedge funds. So there's not a lot of transparency, even among the publicly held corporations that feed at the trough of mass incarceration. You know, they're not all, you know, they're not all publicly held. And, you know, but what they do have in common, though, is generally they've got a big lack of transparency. They're not providing a lot of, you know, they're generally not providing much in the way of either transparency or accountability or anything like that.
You know, I said at the beginning of this segment that there are so many issues that we need to bring up. As much as I want to dwell on a couple, there are so many that are important that I think we ought to move on. There was a very interesting story, Paul, that you ran in Prison Legal News. The story is from Florida, and it's entitled Department of Homeland Security Snitch Busted for Trying to Sell Informant Status to Federal Prisoner. What's that all about?
So basically, part of the reality is that in this country, once people are sentenced for a federal crime, they're either going to serve 85% of their sentence, or basically that's about it. The only way you can really reduce your sentence, short of a pardon or a commutation from the president, is to get status with the government as a cooperating informant or a cooperating witness, which is basically turning in other criminals, real or imagined, in exchange for a sentence reduction. I think one of the jokes is, you know, give us three and you go free. And one federal judge commented on this practice that I think the judge's quote was along the lines that this has turned our nation's penitentiaries into molehills of informant activity. And so this was a case where an informant was plotting to sell information to a federal prisoner about a drug trafficking operation. So basically, the prisoner had nothing to do with any of the drug trafficking operation, but the informant was going to give him the information in turn for the prisoner to go to the federal officials, pretend to be the informant with the information, and hopefully, from his perspective, someone would get arrested or convicted based on the information he was buying from the actual informant, and then he would get a sentence reduced. And so that was, you know, so that was basically, you know, that was basically what the scheme was. And I think this also kind of points, I think, to, you know, just the level of desperation that mass incarceration, especially at the federal level, has created, is that you have so many people doing sentences that they're literally ready to fraudulently convict other people of criminal activity, which may or may not even exist. And of course, one of the things that we noted in the article was the irony was that the federal prisoner who attempted to purchase the information from the informant will now be eligible for a sentence reduction in exchange for his cooperation against the guy that was trying to sell him the information.
Yeah. Yeah, the irony was not lost on me.
That's the whole thing. I mean, the whole snitch sort of institutions that law enforcement at all levels use, I mean, it's turning communities against each other. It's turning people against each other. And the bottom line, the foundation of it is, of course, desperation.
It is.
And the desperation is also based on the severe sentencing in America. You know, Paul, I met with a couple guys yesterday who are ex-prisoners, and they're trying to start a prison magazine. Actually, they didn't know about this segment. I told them about it, and I told them about you. And one of them, they both told me they were young men in their early 20s, but the person who was the guiding light in their life was one of the guy's stepfather, and he's been in prison since 1992 with mandatory life for a drug charge. Now, you know, we're talking 26 years later, the guy, and they said, this man is the anchor of our family. He's the one who's kept people, even from prison, kept everybody else on track. They're trying to set up a prison magazine, actually, because they want prisoners who are writing to them to be able to have an outlet. it's just a, it's kind of an, another reality that people who are not caught up in the system don't know about the system. They think the people in the system are just really hardcore criminals. They're not, you know, nobody should actually care about their suffering. But it's this other reality. And in fact, when you look at the number of people in prison or on probation or parole or their families that are affected by it, we're talking about population numbers that are bigger than probably half the countries of the world. I mean, it really is like a prison nation.
Well, and I think that one of the things is that one of the things to keep in mind is that if everyone in prison were in one geographical place instead of scattered around 5,000 prisons and jails around the country, we'd be talking a city the size of Houston, if not a little bit bigger. And like the city of Houston, it's one that's growing exponentially every day, every year, it continues to grow. I think, but one of the things that I think that's really critical, though, is when you talk about, you know, when you say the thing about that people, that the popular image that's popularized or that's pushed is that of that people in prison are the quote hardened criminals or whatever. You know, I think that one of the things that we have to do is we have to note the extraordinary lengths that the government goes through to both ensure the dehumanization of prisoners and people caught up in the criminal justice system, as well as maintaining that dehumanization. Because I think that one of the things that we've found in every context is that when you dehumanize people, it's easy to do things to them, or it's easy to do bad things to them. And I think that, you know, you see this in the military context where, you know, whoever the opponents of the U.S. of the day are, whether it's the Germans in World War II, the Russians in the Cold War, the Vietnamese, whoever, you know, they get dehumanized. And you know, and that's a real... it's almost like a real easy tactic. And one of the things, this is why anything that purports to humanize prisoners and their families or that gives them any type of humanity, whether it's like, you know, art shows or I remember a couple of years ago, VH1 was doing a series on prison bands, bands in prison. And Pennsylvania had apparently a fairly robust music program where prisoners were allowed to have musical instruments. They were allowed to play instruments and actually have bands. And a couple times a year, the prisoner bands would put on performances for the prison population. And the show aired, and literally the next day, Governor Pataki disbanded and destroyed all of the music program. He forbade musical instruments. He forbade bands and that. And the federal prison system, at one point, they allowed prisoners to have musical instruments. They also put the kibosh on that and destroyed that. And again, I think this is one of the things. Anything that allows people to relate to people is just that, as people rather than as a status, of being a prisoner or a felon or a defendant or whatever, that's something that the government actually puts a lot of time and energy into opposing and pushing against that.
We're speaking from Lake Worth, Florida, with Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News magazine. And this is our usual weekly segment called Criminal Injustice. Paul, I want to talk about crooked cops for a minute, too. There's an article that you sent to us that was deeply disturbing. It's entitled, "Why Did a Top North Carolina Prison Officer Hide Bloody Shanks in His Office Ceiling?" This article includes a video from one of the local news channels in North Carolina showing that a unit manager, which is a relatively high-ranking official in a prison, not only encouraged a murder, he encouraged one prisoner to murder another, but he sanctioned it and then helped to cover up the murder. What can you tell us about that?
So basically there's been, you know, I think that one of the things that's no surprise for those who cover prison issues on an ongoing basis is that a lot of the violence in prisons is fomented by prison employees, whether it's the guards or at the management level or whatever. And this includes everything from smuggling in of contraband and, you know, bringing contraband into the facilities to, you know, allowing gangs to kind of run amok. And one of my observations that I made a long time ago was that basically you don't have prison gangs or organized crime without government support. If the government doesn't support organized crime, it just doesn't exist. And in this case, what it came out was that the top supervisor or one of the supervisors at at this prison at the Lanesboro Correctional Institution in North Carolina, a guy named Lawrence Parsons, that he kept weapons in his ceilings. And I think that the most obvious conclusion to be drawn is that he had the weapons, he would give them to prisoners, and who would carry out his bidding. And one of the videos that's attached to the news story shows Wall meeting with gang members a few minutes before those prisoners, armed with shanks, then get involved in a fight that kills a prisoner named Wesley Turner. And it seems pretty clear that he's providing the weapons to the prisoners, and and he's certainly complicit in the murder, if not actually ordering it. And because I think that's one of those things, I think no one you can talk to, whatever their view on criminal justice is going to say that there's a legitimate reason for a prison administrator to be having, makeshift weapons in his office ceiling, much less or in their possession. And so, I think that's one of the, I think this is just kind of, it's a rare window that's being shed on this aspect of prison corruption and brutality is that, I think that's one of those things is that so much of what happens around oppressive prison measures are with the claim that they're needed to maintain prison security, to keep contraband out, stuff like that. I mean, these are like the rote lies that prison officials tout all the time. And I think that when you start examining, like, okay, well, how does the bulk of prison contraband get into these facilities? And, at the end of the day, I think it just comes down to, what everyone basically knows is that the bulk of the contraband in prisons comes in through either directly through the guards and staff or with their active support and connivance.
Right. There was also a very interesting lawsuit filed. I'm trying to push this because we're running short on time now, but it was filed by over a prison rape video that the Times reported on. What was that all about?
Yeah, so Sheriff Marlon Gussman, he's the longtime sheriff of the New Orleans Parish Jail, which I would say is probably fair to say is one of the most brutal and corrupt jails in the country. And so he's claiming that the New York Times did a very powerful op-ed piece featuring a former prisoner who'd been sexually assaulted in prison, talking about his experiences of being sexually assaulted in Louisiana. And where the good sheriff took offense to this is that the prisoner was actually raped in a different prison or a different jail, and the video voiceover, the video narrative showed the New Orleans jail in the background. And so the sheriff is claiming that the New York Times has defamed him because viewers could think that the sexual assault occurred at the New Orleans jail instead of the one that it actually occurred at. So anyway, so that's kind of that's the point of his suit. But I think it's worth noting, though, that, part of the reality, though, is that he may not be actually complicit in this rape, but there's been videos, for example, showing prisoners gambling and armed prisoners having guns inside the jails. And the jail itself has, extremely high levels of violence and everything else. And of course, corruption, brutality. It's just a real cesspool. So, I mean, this is, to me, it's the height of irony to have Marlon Gussman filing a defamation suit against the New York Times, where he's claiming that he's being basically portrayed in an unfavorable light. So, which I think the light shines very unfavorably on Sheriff Gussman, regardless of what the subject matter is.
Paul, we have 3 minutes left, and I want to turn to politics for the remainder of our time. There was a terrific article that I saw. Let's see, where was this? At TYT, talking about Representative Henry Cuellar, who's a pretty well-known congressman from Texas. He's a Democrat, relatively conservative Democrat. He was one of only 18 Democrats to vote in favor of private prisons. As it turns out, he received $16,500 from the political action committees of private prison.
Is there a connection? Are you trying to suggest something, John?
Imagine that. This is Geo Group and Core Civic that Paul mentioned a few minutes ago. Now, this was the vote on ICE, right? It was a GOP resolution in support of ICE. Democrats were instructed by their leadership to vote present, and 138 of them did exactly that. They voted present. A small handful voted yes. Only one Republican voted no, which was kind of funny. Cuellar voted yes. He bucked his party's leadership. And the implication in this article is because he received so much money in from the PACs of Core Civic and the Geo Group. Paul, is this unusual? Is this something that's special, or is this business as usual on Capitol Hill? We have 2 minutes.
This is very much business as usual. I think when you look at all the generally, I mean, you know, politicians are being paid for their votes in favor of these industries. And, you know, one of the things I think is really perverse about the private prison industry is this whole money laundering prospect of what happens. These companies get these contracts not because they're so great or because they provide such good services or they're well managed. They get them because of lobbying, campaign donations, and cronyism. And I think this is one of those typical cases where they dole out the campaign money, which these donations, just remember, every penny these companies get comes from a taxpayer somewhere, either a federal or state taxpayer. They have no private customer base. So basically, the politicians make the decision to give these companies the contracts, the cage people, and then the companies are basically recycling a portion of that contract money back to the politicians that send them the contracts. And so it kind of sets up this vicious cycle of basically the campaign donations with the government paid for by the government contracts that in turn they get, and it sets up kind of this revolving cycle of taxpayer money, some of which gets siphoned off back into the campaign coffers of the politicians that send them the contracts.
On its face, that would be called organized crime, completely organized.
But we call it business as usual here.
We call it democracy.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think it's worth noting that some of the big, I mean, there's a notion that somehow the Democrats have problems with private prisons or mass incarceration, but they don't. If anything, they've been the architects of it under Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton is the one who bailed out the private prison industry in 1999 with these sweetheart immigration contracts. I mean, CCA and GEO at the time, they were in the process of being delisted from the New York Stock Exchange. Their shares were trading at 19 or 20 cents a piece when Bill Clinton came to the rescue. If it weren't for Bill Clinton, the private prison industry would have imploded under the weight of its own corruption and mismanagement 20 years ago.
A lot of Americans got rich thanks to Bill Clinton.
The prisons were too big to fail.
Yeah, that's right. Too big to fail. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. Paul is the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center, and he's also the editor of Prison Legal News Magazine, which I highly recommend. I'm a longtime subscriber. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back with a lot more.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.